happens in grade two this year, and although my own kind of primary school days are an increasingly hazy memory, a couple of memories do stand out for me. One that's very vivid is I remember playing in the playground one lunchtime, and the sort of head teacher came out and called to me to come in and get some lemonade. And I went, okay. And so I went into the sort of staff room, thought it was a bit odd, but rolled with it. I watched her pull out a mug, crack open the bottle of lemonade, pour it in, and as I kind of greedily took hold of the mug and leaned down over it, I remember the bubbles kind of fizzing up under my nose, the teacher sharply interrupted, "It's not for you, it's for the teacher on yard duty, take it out to her." Who something is for is a very significant question in many areas of life. And it's a question I want to open up with you this morning from that reading from John's Gospel. Who is Jesus for is the question. It's a significant question because it really matters if you get it wrong. Much more than the lemonade. I mean, I imagine that would have mattered a bit if I'd kind of taken a swig because I would have got into trouble. As it was, I was just sort of mildly embarrassed. But if you think Jesus is for you and he isn't, then you've had your hopes up only to have them dashed. And maybe worse, if you think that Jesus isn't for you and he is, then you risk missing out on something truly amazing and life-changing. Maybe some of you are here this morning because you're trying to sort this question out, to work out, is Jesus for me? If that's so, then that's fantastic. I'm really pleased you're here today, and I'm confident that God has something for you. Or perhaps you feel you've settled this question one way or another. Either you're convinced that Jesus, yes, is for me, or you're convinced he isn't. Well, prepare to be unsettled. Because the question of who Jesus is for is the very question that's hovering in the air as we turn to this passage in John chapter 4. It's a question that's in the air in the early chapters of John's Gospel. And it's brought into sharp focus right here at the very beginning in John 4 verse 43. Have a look with me. After 2 days, Jesus left for Galilee. Now, Jesus himself had pointed out that a prophet has no honour in his own country. In the previous passage, which you considered together last week, Jesus had been in Samaria. In first century Palestine, Samaria is kind of wedged between the two Jewish regions, Judea and the area around Jerusalem down in the south, and Galilee and the area that Jesus' human family hails from up in the north. But Jesus has been in Samaria in the middle. But now John tells us Jesus departs for Galilee. He's headed to his hometown. This completes the circle in which he's travelled in the earlier chapters of John. Back in chapter 2, he was in Cana, up in Galilee, where he performed the miracle of turning water into wine to save a local wedding. Then he travelled to Jerusalem, where he made a kind of scene in the temple. And now, after a brief stopover in Samaria, he heads back to Galilee, with Cana as his eventual destination, as we discover a little bit later in verse 43. Now, more than just a tour of kind of key sites in the Holy Land, although I have some friends who've recently done that, but this is a bit more than that. This itinerary of Jesus raises the question of who Jesus is for. Is Jesus for the Jews of Jerusalem? Most Jews at the time probably would have assumed so. Jerusalem was the centre of the people's religious and social life. It got big billing in the Old Testament. It was the city of David, the ancient capital. And there are many, many promises all throughout the prophets that say Jerusalem is where God's going to do his renewing work. He's going to turn up to protect it, to vindicate it, to transform it. Is Jesus for Jerusalem? Or is Jesus for the Jews of his own country, up in Galilee? I mean, he seems to be spending a fair bit of time with them. And more than that, he does signs there in this passage as well as back in chapter 2. And these signs, John tells us, are the means by which Jesus reveals who he is. He reveals his glory. Although at the time, Galilean Jews were regarded by the southern folk as backwater hicks. I asked a friend, and they said it might be a bit like how people here in Ballarat and Buninyong might regard people from Ararat. I don't know, I just asked a friend. Maybe that's offended some people here. But could Jesus somehow be for them? And why? Is Jesus for the people of Galilee? Add to this the fact that in the previous part of the story that John was telling, Jesus hasn't just been crisscrossing the physical geographical landscape of first century Palestine. He's also been traversing the social and religious landscape. Back down in Jerusalem, John reports Jesus meeting with Nicodemus, a social and religious insider, a Pharisee, a leader of the people. And Nicodemus seeks Jesus out, and that's a pretty good sign. And he's initially kind of respectful and deferential to Jesus, but he does it all kind of a bit sneakily at night time, and he ends up sort of pulling back. He rejects Jesus and what he's saying, or at least he does at this point in John's Gospel. His story goes on and has a bit of a twist. So it's not so promising, actually, when Jesus is dealing with insiders like Nicodemus down in Jerusalem. But we saw last week, actually, that he has a much more promising encounter with a rank outsider, the woman from Samaria. You would remember that in the eyes of the Jews of the time, she was a complete outsider, a no-go zone. She was a Samaritan. They were not quite Jews, not quite pagans. Ethnically, they were mixed race, and religiously, they held to the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, but rejected the rest. So they're sort of religiously a bit mixed. She was a woman, and what's worse, she was divorced. Respectable Jewish rabbis at the time avoided contact with women wherever possible, even their own wives in public, some of them, and especially when there were people like this woman who people might raise questions about who she was, her status, and that kind of thing. She's an outsider, but Jesus had not only spoken with her, he'd led her to faith, and then gained a very fruitful hearing among the townspeople off the back of her witness. I was recently on a trip to India. I went to Mumbai for 2 days. Everyone who saw or heard of my itinerary wanted to know why. Well, I mean, what's in India and why would you travel all that way for just 2 days? I mean, that's a good question. It was a long way to travel. It was a work trip and I was taking part in some training for the church planting agency that I work for. But my itinerary raised questions, and Jesus' itinerary, his physical itinerary, and the social itinerary, the people he's kind of travelled to and fro from, raises these questions. Who is Jesus for? Making things even more complicated, John comments on Jesus' own itinerary in verse 44 by saying that Jesus himself had pointed out that a prophet has no honour in his own country. So this sharpens up the question of who Jesus is for, right? Because he's going back to his own country, and John tells us Jesus knows that prophets have no honour in their own country. He was from there, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's for the people there, or that they're going to be for him. Strangely, though, Jesus does go and is welcomed in Galilee. They welcome him in verse 45 because they'd seen all he'd done in Jerusalem at the Passover festival. So they've been wowed and impressed by him. In a sense, they're glad to have him home, probably. They can bask in some of the reflected glory. You know, every time we see an Australian in a Hollywood movie, you know, our Hugh Jackman, or when we hear the nasal twang of our Nicole Kidman, mostly in television commercials now, But anyway, that's another matter. We distance ourselves from their worst antics or flop movies, but we love to claim them as ours when we feel that could reflect well on us, don't we? And so we bring these same questions, or we're supposed to bring these questions, to Jesus' encounter with the royal official here in the end part of John chapter 4. Have a look from verse 46. Once more Jesus visited Cana in Galilee, where he had turned the water into wine. And there was a certain royal official whose son lay sick at Capernaum. When this man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went to him and begged him to come and heal his son who was close to death. Now, to start with, this official seems like another outsider. He's in a similar category to the Samaritan woman. He's a Galilean, not a Jerusalemite. He's from Hicksville, but he's one of Jesus' countrymen. He's also an official employed by the hated King Herod Antipas. Unlike the Samaritan woman, he's not an ethnic or religious outsider. This man is a political rather than a cultural or religious outsider. And he comes to Jesus for help because his son is close to death. Lying sick at the time, not just a matter of a sort of slight sniffle and a headache, the condition of the official's son is so desperate that it motivates him to slog all the way uphill from Capernaum down by the shore of the lake up to Cana in the hills, because he's seeking out Jesus to beg him for help. Now, perhaps you've experienced things that have motivated you to slog uphill to see Jesus and beg him for help. And perhaps you know people who have. I personally remember the sheer sort of terror and desperation that drove me to prayer as the team in the operating theatre pulled my firstborn child from my wife with forceps. And I remember the agonising 30 seconds or so while they were trying to get him to breathe. And maybe you know something of how that feels. And this man knew he was at the end of himself. Totally desperate, completely powerless. He knows he needs Jesus. And so he goes. He turns up. He seeks him out. And then things take a surprising turn. Now look at verse 48. Jesus responds to the man's desperate request kind of dismissively. Unless you people see signs and wonders, Jesus told him, you will never believe. The man comes to Jesus, badly in need of help. And Jesus seems to meet him, not with compassion, but with something like a rebuke. At one level, it sounds like Jesus wants this man off his back. What's going on here? Does Jesus somehow see into this man's heart and perceive in his desperation not faith, but just a chasing of kind of power, to get hold of the power that comes with being close to Jesus, the travelling spiritual sound and light show that can help him? I mean, that may be true, if not for this royal official, then for the people of Galilee, the crowds, who are happy to have Jesus home. Again and again, Jesus' own people in John's Gospel seem to be interested in what he can do for them rather than in him. They sort of want Jesus on their own terms. They look to him to give them sort of divine performance enhancement, help in achieving their current goals, rather than looking to him as someone around whom to shape their goals. And so maybe in this sharp rebuke that Jesus administers, he's highlighting a spiritual danger. A danger of focusing on the signs, the things that Jesus can do, whether miraculous or not. Because it's a mistake to remain focused just on the spectacular things Jesus does. to be impressed simply by what he can or has done for you, to give his deeds your admiration rather than giving him your heart. Because Jesus doesn't want your mere admiration, even for the amazing things he can and does do. He doesn't want you to stop there. He doesn't want you to get fixated on the gifts that he gives, good as they are, but to see in them his generosity and goodness. He wants you to thank and praise and worship him, to trust him, to surrender to him as the generous and good giver. So Jesus administers this kind of rebuke, a bit cryptic, and then the story takes another surprising turn, because the royal official won't be put off, will he? He takes Jesus' rebuke on the chin and he persists. Verse 49, the royal official said, "Sir, come down before my child dies." This man, it turns out, wants Jesus. He's hungry for his presence and saving power. He knows that that's what his son needs. Nothing less will do. In responding like this, the man proves that he does want Jesus. He doesn't just want what he can get from him. He wants him. He needs him. Because actually the idea that we should want Jesus rather than just what we can get from Jesus is, it's only partly right, isn't it? It's right in one direction but not in the other, if that makes any sense. Because when you do have Jesus, you have him clothed in his promises. You have him along with all his gifts and benefits. Now you can look at it like this. Jesus does want your heart, your allegiance and trust. But he's no tyrant. He doesn't want to empty your life. He wants to fill it and to enlarge your ideas of fullness along the way. But Jesus only entrusts himself to people who entrust themselves to him. And when he does, he comes to them and fills their lives. He's for them, as he is for this man. You see there, verse 50. "Go," Jesus replied, "your son will live." The man took Jesus at his word and departed. Now this royal official receives from Jesus what he desperately needed. And you notice he believed Jesus not because he'd seen a sign. He's unlike the Galileans who Jesus says, "You just want to see signs." He sees nothing. He just has Jesus' word, his promise that his son would live. And that's enough for this man. He believes. He goes obeying Jesus' instruction and trusting his promise. And he receives exactly what was promised at the very hour. Isn't that beautiful there in verse 51? "While he was still on the way, his servants met him with the news that his boy was living. When he inquired as to the time when his son got better, they said to him, 'Yesterday at 1 PM the fever left him.' Then the father realized that this was the exact time at which Jesus had said to him, 'Your son will live.' So he and his whole household believed." Now that final detail is pretty striking, isn't it? This man and his whole household believed. One of the marks of the genuineness of this royal official's faith, one of the key pieces of evidence that this outsider, socially and politically, is actually an insider in kingdom terms. The key mark is displayed when his faith proves infectious. He can't keep it to himself. His belief in Jesus can't be separated from his household's belief in Jesus. because this man must not have been able to keep his mouth shut about Jesus and about what he'd done. We actually saw the same thing with the Samaritan woman earlier in the chapter. Her belief was infectious too. Others are brought to Jesus through it. And this is only natural, because when you discover something that delivers on its promises, something that fills your life, that brings you blessing, you just want to share it, don't you? My wife and I are kind of foodies. We especially love spicy food. We're effectively on a quest to find and eat all the amazing Thai food, wherever it is, whenever we can. And early in our marriage, we realised that we'd become kind of unpaid salespeople for our favourite Thai curry sauce brand. We just can't help it. I mean, we love it. It's awesome. And so we recommend it to others. And you can see me later if you want to know which one it is. It's Mayploy, by the way. Can't help myself. C.S. Lewis puts it like this. He says, "It's not out of compliment that lovers keep on telling one another how beautiful they are. The delight is incomplete till it's expressed. It's frustrating to have discovered a new author and not be able to tell anyone how good he is. To come suddenly at the turn of the road upon some mountain valley of unexpected grandeur and then to have to keep silent because the people with you care for it no more than for a tin can in the ditch. Or to hear a good joke and find no one to share it with. Every good thing, everything that fills your heart and gives you life, finds natural expression in words. Words of praise and of invitation for others to check it out and find the benefit and blessing there in the curry sauce or whatever." And it's worth pausing to reflect. If you're someone who calls yourself a Christian and trusts Jesus, are you like this? Is your belief infectious? Do you naturally want others to find blessing in the one you've been blessed by? To meet the person who's the source of every blessing and good thing in your life? Now, don't get me wrong, right? I'm not suggesting that you need a kind of personality transplant. They have to become some sort of extroverted, conversational show stealer if you're not already. Just be yourself. But I think we all have our kind of gushes, don't we? The things that we just take delight in, find so life-giving that it can be hard to stop us commending them to others. And maybe if you don't know what it is for you, ask someone close to you. They'll probably tell you, yeah, it's this. Can't shut you up. You always talk about it. So it's worth asking yourself, if you don't gush in your own way in response to Jesus, where that might place you. More on the side of the doubting insiders, the people like Nicodemus? Or if you might need to recover more of your outsider status, like this royal official or the Samaritan woman, people who need Jesus and know it. You see, left to ourselves, we're all outsiders. In fact, it's our natural state. We are, each one of us, much, much further on the outside when it comes to God than we care to admit. John begins his gospel by highlighting this. He says, "No one of their own willing or choosing even has the desire to become a child of God, let alone the ability to do so." Much further on the outside than we're comfortable with. But the good news is, this isn't the end of the story, is it? Because as we see here in this story of the royal official, and as John's gospel shows us time and time again, even though Jesus knew he would be rejected and dishonored by his own, he comes to them. He chooses to. He makes the journey from Samaria to Galilee, from heaven to earth. He puts one foot in front of the other, even though it's the road to the cross that he's walking. You see, the story behind the story we read here in John chapter 4, the story behind all the stories in John's Gospel, is that the ultimate insider, the Lord Jesus, the Son of God the Father, became an outsider so that we who are on the outside can be brought in. God's own Son went to death to rescue not just this man's dying son, but all of us. And to the extent that we grasp hold of this, we'll pay attention not only to the signs and the good things that Jesus does, but to the one they're pointing to. And to the extent that we grasp hold of it, we'll give him our heart, surrendering to Jesus in trusting obedience and worship. And to the extent that we grasp this, we'll gush about him without having someone tighten the screws on us, you know, to please the pastor or fit the church program or whatever, but naturally, infectiously, because we know how good he is and we just want to help other people see that. Let me pray. Our gracious God, we thank you for the Gospel of John and for the way it shows us Jesus come for us. We pray that by your Spirit this would be something that lodges in our hearts and minds, that causes us to lift our eyes to him, to give him the thanks and praise of our hearts, and to commend him to others naturally, because we know how good he is, how good he's been to us. Amen.